The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So thanks everyone for being here. Before we get started on the parami of truthfulness, did anyone want to say anything in response to how practicing with patience went this past week? I know I, for one, was acutely aware of my impatience at times. Anything in particular that was noteworthy?
I was paying attention to impatience in phone calls, business, you know, when you're on with the, I noticed there's like irritation, and then I blame, it's like something the other person's doing. And one of the things I always say thank you when people are patient with me, and here I am going around like, so I caught that, and in I see it a lot too. Several times during the week, I caught it and actually turned it around. I breathed, and then I just started kind of chit-chatting. I'm like, you know, where am I going? Like, big deal. And I had lovely conversations with these people. We ended up having really, you know, just pleasant. So I appreciated that because I was aware of that, but I hadn't worked with it intentionally. Mm-hmm. So I think it had a benefit.
Thanks.
I'm going to keep that up, by the way.
Oh, good. Anyone else want to say anything about practicing with patience?
Yeah, this has been a challenging week. It's funny when a person puts that intention out there and then how the universe throws all kinds of earth homework at a person. We already had it to be, I say we, my partner and I, because we've been looking for renters for next door in the duplex that we live in. And that in itself, during the COVID-19, is an extraordinary time to be even trying doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then to try and have patience. Well, let's put it this way. I was very aware when I was impatient, which was a lot of times, and found it to be very stressful doing this. But the other day, I kind of had a little bit of a breakthrough. And this was the other day when Kamala Masters and Steve Armstrong spoke. And what Kamala kind of, I'm not quoting perfectly, but what I love, they were discussing compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, she says, I just like to keep it really simple. In terms of practicing the Brahma Viharas, because I've been doing the metta and I have multiple different phrases. But then she said compassion. And she says, I use this simple phrase, something to the effect of, may my heart be open to this. Mm-hmm. And that's all she said. And I thought, oh yeah. And then I tried it. And I could try it all over the place because there's so much going on, not just with us, but on this planet. And I felt like there was a sense of spaciousness or space when I did that. When I practiced that in many different venues. And that helped to release some of my impatience. I still have that impatience there. But that really helped. I think combining compassion with patience, that practice, I found very helpful.
Thank you. And, you know, and even that... that phrase about an open heart, I noticed in my impatient times this week that I would I just noticed that sense of constriction about feeling I need to get this done, wanting someone else to speed things, and just watching that kind of constriction. And I think maybe remembering a phrase like, can I just be here with an open heart? Can I open my heart? And just the reminder, the reminder to open, I think would be a useful way of working with patients. So thank you for suggesting that. So our parami today is truthfulness, and in Pali it's Sacca, S-A-C-C-A, and it's truthfulness, and it has the elements of trustworthiness, sincerity, and honesty. And in my reading about this parami, I came across a comment by Joseph Goldstein, who said that truthfulness is the antidote to self-delusion. Truthfulness is the antidote to self-delusion. And the query is sort of, are we really seeing, first of all, seeing ourselves truthfully? Before we sort of move on to truthfulness in speech, with ourselves, are we seeing ourselves truthfully? Do we see our unwholesome qualities and tendencies? And do we also see our wholesome qualities and tendencies? And I know that both Nancy and Carol have been part of this weekday Dharma presentation that Steve and Kamala have been doing. And Steve has been talking a lot in the past couple of days about how, you know, we shouldn't be wedded to an idea of our, you know, I'm an aversive type, or, that we sort of congeal around sometimes or identify with what is unwholesome, and to see those as kind of states that arise and pass away. But it is really important to be aware of those, whatever our unwholesome tendencies are. Do we see ourselves truthfully? And for me, it's always been saying, you know, do I have a kind of story about myself? And one of the stories I would sometimes tell myself is, oh, poor me. Why do I always have to be the responsible one? You know, why am I always the adult in this situation? You know, it was this sort of pitying, self-pitying, poor me. And I would just watch that come up. And it was not truthful, not helpful, but something that I had actually fed quite a bit. And that would kind of come up, you know, just in meditation. I would be meditating, and then I would have a thought about kind of how put upon I was. And just to see that was really, really helpful, to see that it wasn't true. And it was a story that I had sort of identified with. It's also really important to see when our story about ourselves is a story of unworthiness. And Tara Brach is probably the teacher who has probably talked about this and written about it most exhaustively. She talks about that sort of trance of unworthiness. But Joseph says, for example, we need to see unworthiness as a wrong view of self. To see this as wrong view if we consider ourselves unworthy. And just to notice that that's kind of a defilement, that unworthiness, this sense of unworthiness, this idea of unworthiness, that's a wrong view of ourself. And so I think that's a, a very helpful reminder. And I think particularly in a culture that is very perfectionistic, that is very critical, that is very comparative, always judging. And we're sort of, if we're not the absolute best, we're not good enough. I mean, that seems to be a sort of a theme often. And to really get that that is a wrong view, if that's the view we have of ourselves. If we're not the best, we're not good enough, we're not worthy. And so, looking at this parami, that this first part is really to look with that open heart that Carol mentioned. You know, what are the views that we have of ourselves, the opinions, and just be aware of them. And some of them we may be able to hold more lightly than others, and to realize their impermanent nature too. And to really bring some attention to recognizing our good qualities, our strengths. And that's not something that we often do. I mean, I remember when I was I think I was probably about 9 years old. I asked my mother, I was one of four children, I was one of the middle children. I asked my mother what my best quality was. And I really expected her to say that I was very smart. But she said, "Patrice, I think you are a generous person." And I can't tell you how that really formed me in a way as a kid, that I really took that to heart. And because my mother was an extremely, I thought, intelligent, perceptive person, and I would never have said that about myself. But growing up, I thought of myself as a generous person. And I've always remembered that about how important it is, you know, with children to note their good qualities, to note their kindliness. And I just remember that has really had an important effect on my life, that my mother told me that I was a generous person. So I think that it's useful for us to pay attention to those qualities that are those good qualities that are strongest in ourselves, and really appreciate them. And if we have some sort of attachment to a view of ourselves, to really look at that. And with this light of truthfulness, and see what that attachment is about, and it might very well be a kind of a wrong view. That almost any time we have a really fixed idea about something, it is very likely to be a wrong view. So that's where we begin in talking about truthfulness, and this. Can also help bring us to an investigation where we try to understand the conditioned natures of our mind, our view of self and others. And what's been talked about a lot in the past couple of years has been this idea of implicit bias, where we have these generalized attitudes about race, gender, size, class, ethnicity, religion, geography, where we just have this sort of attitude. And it's a matter of our conditioning, a matter of our experiences, and to just try to bring those forward into our consciousness. And I would also just encourage anyone who is interested in investigating this more to do the implicit association test that is available through Harvard. But before you do that, I would also really encourage you to listen to a podcast that was on the hidden brain about 2 weeks ago. And it really talks, and I think the word, how differences matter, I think is the title, but it was about 2 weeks ago. And it really talks about how the implicit association test came into being and what its uses are and some of the criticisms of it, that it's not adequate to change our minds. But it was a very, very even-handed discussion of the implicit association test. And I think it's a really good thing to listen to before you actually do the test. And I've taken it a couple of times for different issues, like around homelessness, around race, and gender issues. But, you know, sort of understanding some of our own biases, our own attitudes, that because they're so amorphous and general in our minds, are not always really consciousness. So we can make an effort to become aware of our implicit biases, to let them go, to recondition. And I heard of an interesting effort that some person, a woman, who said that she had always feared adult Black men, that if she saw an adult Black man, she just had this kind of natural shrinking. And she said, so her practice was every time she saw an adult Black man, she would say to herself, wise and kind. Wise and kind. And, you know, you could do that with homeless persons. You sort of recondition your mind. And it's not something that works permanently. I remember reading about someone who had as their screensaver a woman in a hard hat breastfeeding a child. And that was what they used to sort of remind themselves to let go of the sort of narrow thinking and biases. So we can, we can really work with something like that in the sense of having a more truthful, more accurate, not only a perception of other people, but sort of just sorting out our own minds, so that, we can eventually, our preferences can just be preferences. You know, the kind of ice cream you like, the kind of food you like, the kind of music you like, that we can have preferences, and they're just preferences. They're not these sorts of biases that make us judge one thing superior to another. And a really good example, what for me was a tremendous example in learning about this, was years ago when I worked in the arts and was writing a lot of criticism. And I had a friend who was a poet, J. Otis Powell, the late J. Otis Powell. And he would give me his poems, and they just have everything in them. Lots of metaphors, lots of images. And I would always think, you take one, you have one metaphor, one image, kind of the dominant motif, and then you have little variations. And I think in painting, there's the foreground, there's the background. And I was looking at, and Jay was always saying to me, but it's all in there. It's all in there. Everything belongs. And I was looking at some African-American art, and there was so much going on. And it wasn't, foreground, middle ground, background, and it was lots of different color and the sort of polyrhythmic music. And I finally got, this was an aesthetic of abundance. This was not an aesthetic of ordering. It was not, sort of the ballet with the prima ballerina and the dancer and then the core. It was not, you know, sort of a recreation of feudal Europe. That this was an aesthetic of abundance. And so much African-American work was that way, that it was inclusive. Everything belonged. And it was just a different aesthetic. And you know, it really changed, you know, blew my mind to realize, oh, this is just a different aesthetic. And once I got that, I could really, really appreciate the work. But I had this bias that was pretty unconscious to me about, you know, what a poem, how a poem should be, how a painting should be. And it was, you know, also, you know, the sort of Aristotelian, you know, beginning, middle, end. And it was just, it was so freeing. I guess that's what I want to say. You know, when we can see these biases in ourselves, it is such a taste of freedom. And first it's horrible, right? First it's shocking. But then when we can let go of that, when we can kind of break through that, when that comes up and we can just see it for what it is such a taste of freedom. So this is, you know, part of this idea about truthfulness is, first of all, just working with our own minds and really having, you know, all of the other virtues we've talked about, bringing that to the investigation of our own minds, and just being able to hang in there till we can have this sort of truthful sense of ourselves in a way. And then the arena that we are probably more familiar in working in truthfulness, and that is in speech. And the Buddha's guidelines on speech are, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it timely? And is it offered without ill will? And last week, Carol said, no, for the one, is it timely? Like, what's the context in which we're speaking? So is it true? Is it helpful? And another way of saying that is, does this need to be said? Does this need to be said? What's the context in which we're saying it? And can it be said without ill will? And, you know, we might not always be able to sort of meet all those four conditions, but it really helps us to be aware of that. It really helps us if we can, first of all, pay attention to the truthfulness of things. And, you know, there is such a temptation to pass on information that reinforces our own position, our own likes, our own dislikes. And it's so easy now to just, copy a link and send it or respond. I mean, I think that, and this is not news to anyone, that the sort of, the ease of the internet has made it really possible for all of us to engage in a kind of hasty and thoughtless speech. I mean, I find that's a real, it's just so easy to do that. So to really, really pay attention to, is something truthful? Does it need to be said? That question of, is it helpful speech? Is it timely? What's the context for it? And finally, are we offering it without ill will? And you know, when we sort of mess up in our speech, are we willing to sort of make an amends? Are we willing to repair? Because the benefit of being truthful, the benefit to each of us, is that the more truthful we are, the more trustworthy we are, the more people will trust us. Many years ago, when I was my first faculty job, I said some very intemperate things at my first faculty senate meeting or something, faculty meeting, and feeling very righteous and very feminist, and someone that I had only met came up to me afterwards and said, "You know, if you continue to say things like another woman," he said, "you know," he said, "I understand that what you said was true, but if you continue to say things like that in the faculty senate, you will be dead in the water," or something to that effect. And I thought immediately, this person is going to be my best friend, because this person was really telling me the truth about how to sort of make my way in this context. And I think it's kind of hard to tell someone something that's difficult about their behavior. Like, you made a really big mistake by asking that question or saying that thing. So I really felt that this person had risked something by saying this truthful thing to me that was in my own best interest. And I just knew that we were going to be really, really, really good friends because of that. And we were. She just died very unexpectedly last fall, but we were, even after I stopped teaching, we would meet once a year at a B&B and hang out for a weekend. We did that for more than 30 years. So, you know, it's just, you know, when someone tells you the truth, you can really trust them. And, you know, that is such, being trustworthy is such a beautiful thing. Because people will know that you will tell them the truth. You are worthy of their trust. You won't dissemble. You know, and you may say difficult things in a very kind and compassionate way, which would be a very good way to say things. But, you know, that idea about telling the truth makes you a trustworthy person. And that really provides the grounds for intimacy. You know, when we feel that we can trust people, we can be really intimate and vulnerable with them, and they can be intimate and vulnerable with us. So I think this is, you know, a life work to really develop this quality of truthfulness. It's a great strength. It really is a strength these days to be able to speak truthfully, to say something that needs to be said, to say it in the appropriate context, and to do it without ill will. So I'd be delighted to hear some of your responses or examples or how you've been working with this. And just unmute yourself and jump in.
Yeah, hi, Patrice. I was in one of Nancy's yoga classes the other day, and she usually gives, you know, a short talk, you know, something about the Dharma as an introduction. And she was talking about, you know, we don't go from delusion to being awake, that you go from, you know, being deluded to being confused. And I'm right now, I'm deep in this confused state. And I could see, you know, how I've been deluded, but I'm not really getting a clear picture of things. And it's just very difficult, you know, especially with relationships I've had with people in my life, where it's just difficult, you know, to maintain friendships, you know, deep friendships with people I've known without annoying them, you know. And that's just my comment, is the truthfulness. I understand this, but you know, and the teachings at Common Ground, especially, you know, like the series you've been doing is wonderful. And by listening to different teachers, I can kind of, you know, get different viewpoints. So, I mean, right now, I feel kind of like anytime you try and learn a skilled activity, you know, in music or art or writing, you know, whatever it is, paddling a kayak, you go, the first part of it is always, you know, the technical aspects of it, you know, being able to play scales and arpeggios, and it takes quite a while before you can produce anything that looks like music, and you just kind of have to suffer with it, and the people that listen to you have to suffer with you too, you know, until you can get it. And So I'm really struggling with that truthfulness right now. You know, what, you know, I can't really judge what, I don't know what's true and what's not true, just because my viewpoints are switching, and I'm seeing so many different sides to things right now, especially, you know, with this unrest, you know, that we're going through, this change.
You know, I think it sounds to me like the truthful thing is to be where you are in this place of not knowing, not being sure. I mentioned, I think when we started out, that I'd had this, my mantra for the year was supposed to be, you know, make space for not knowing. It was one of the things that I was going to really try to practice myself. Make space for not knowing, about not always having to have an opinion right away, of needing to understand right away. Because my own MO is sort of to have an opinion pretty quickly, to try to master the material very quickly. And I'm really trying to make, in my own practice, more space for not knowing. So with some of the issues that have come up recently, around defund the police, I'm really willing just to be kind of open about that and not need to have a real opinion about what should be done, but to really be open to an investigation. And that's probably the most truthful thing I can say, is I don't know what should be done. I know something should be done, but I don't know what. And I'm really open. So I think that, I don't know if this gets at what you're saying, Kevin, but this idea about being really honest when we don't know, that's an important point, to just be really honest when we don't know. And when we don't have an opinion, or we don't know enough to have an opinion. And I think also that there is something in the way in which a lot of interaction takes place that stays on a very superficial level. Mm-hmm. And that when we bring more sincerity and sort of wanting to be more deeper, more vulnerable, more truthful, more intimate, that many people will just want to back off. You know, they'll say things, oh no, now she's going to get serious on this. Now she's going to get all serious about this. Or, you know, there are sometimes in social situations where wanting to really have a deeper conversation, you know, you'll just be with people who are not willing to go there, that who want to keep things at a very official, pleasant, social level. And okay, and that's the way it is in that moment. But I think, and this is a generalization, but I think especially for men talking with men, I think that is hard sometimes when, based on my partner's experience or I'm watching, sometimes I think it's hard, maybe harder for men to have intimate conversations among themselves than for women to have those conversations with men, or women to have them with other women. And I think that's part of just that socialization about, you know, sort of, not being vulnerable.
Number of things you've said have touched me. At the first thing, talking about men, I think what you said is there's a lot in it about men finding it difficult to talk intimately, but I have had experiences in men's groups where it's happened. So it's one of those things that's not an absolute, but just there's a tendency for men to find it more difficult. But I know that in my men's group, it's been extremely intimate with men talking about feelings with each other. The thing I was intending to say was one idea came this week with, we were with friends, like a socially distant dinner, and a friend talked about having different churches at this time. And I really like that idea in terms of, like, that's how I'm feeling at the moment. Because as you've been saying, Patrice, about not knowing, there's a lot of that I have. And, you know, this idea of being able to take from different churches, as it were. One thing I read this yesterday, I think, about Gandhi's idea of experiments in truth. And so this life is a series of experiments in truth, which I really related to, because I've had a lot of that. And some experiments don't work and others do. And I really, really love that. And there was another quote that touched me when I read today from Thomas Merton, talking about so many people live lives of impersonation, self-impersonation, not being true to themselves. And, you know, and I do understand that, because when I wear the hat that I wear in my professional life, I have a different name even in my professional life. I'm Terence in my professional life and Girish in my personal life. And I'm comfortable with it, because in my professional life, I don't really want to, as you've said about, is it true, helpful, timely? In my professional life, sometimes it wouldn't be helpful or timely, or it would be true if I talked about my past experiences, but people would be completely shocked about what I've experienced in my life, and that wouldn't be helpful at all. So it's a dance in a way of like, well, which ballroom are you in? That's the way a metaphor I can be comfortable with it. Am I in, you know, the Sufi work that I've done where it's just can be free movement, or whether I'm in a ballroom situation doing the waltz. Not that I can do the waltz very well, but, yeah, so there's a lot that's going on with that, but I really like the idea of the different, this not knowing. One thing is the continual search and being able to expand my horizons in a lot of ways. And I've been reading White Fragility today, and I've been reading Just Mercy, you know, just to also to try and understand a lot more about the issues of our time. That's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Girish.
Okay. I'd like to say that my understanding or my understanding of truth has quite a lot to do with wisdom. And to know, to be in one's own truth, and to be aware that there are so many different takes on things. And so someone else's truth is going to also be different from mine. We may come to agreements about things, but my experience is going to be my own. And I think that with truth, you also mentioned trust. And I think that it's also very cultural. And it's surprising that, you know, my husband, who is British, and I speak the same language, but culturally, we're constantly having to clarify what it is that is implied or inferred, or what we understand of each other, or what it is, because the cultural differences are very profound, even though we're speaking the same language. And I think that when we start to look at the cultural differences between me being a native New Yorker and coming to the Midwest, coming to the Twin Cities, that the cultural differences there are also huge, and we're all Americans. So it's very, I think that what's happening here, the uprising, the explosion of awareness and violence that is around racism, and then also trying to deal with COVID, has completely changed our reality. And so being truthful is really interesting, because the not knowing is something that is one of the most difficult things to sit with, to be with in oneself, and in having a sense of trust in how things are going to unfold, and we really don't know. And so the truthfulness, as you were saying too, and I make this gesture because I was a dancer and I still sometimes struggle with finding the words, but to articulate what you were talking and pointing to, Patrice, I think that you're saying too, like, you know, we get fixed in our biases, but we get fixed in wanting things to be recognizable, wanting things to be easily identified, wanting things to be, I mean, in a very large picture. And so to be truthful is maybe to come back to our own self, you know, in a way, our heart, how brokenhearted we might each of us be, and how uncertain that is. And realizing that here in this group, we are so, I'm so grateful. You know, to be able to come to different platforms, different churches, different gatherings, to be able somehow to honestly process what's going on within a context and a framework that is spiritual. So, you know, I guess that's my piece, but I want to thank you, but I think that there's a lot of wisdom here in the group itself, you know, for being able to talk about this from a place that's real.
And I think our mindfulness practice really supports us in this as we, as we have all spent time, you know, just sitting with our own minds and just investigating the territory of the heart and the mind over and over and over again. And, I think that really prepares us for these difficult, more public, more social, more interpersonal conversations and explorations and investigations. That time that we spend, just learning about the terrain of the heart and the mind. And as Carol said earlier, and then, having this intention about keeping the heart open. That really is sort of the rudder that will help us navigate this really tremendously volatile time. So it's after 7. Does anyone have any last words they'd like to say briefly before we end for tonight? I really appreciate, as always, you're all being here. It just feels great to investigate these paramis together. And I hope we'll be here next week. So have a good night.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.